now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times on a morning that was made for office debates. Who's killing football? The game's gone. Better known as I'm watching rugby from now on. Pep's a fraud, aka City must buy. Also known as Jamie Vardy channels the agelessness of Dorian Gray. So much to discuss with Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Matt Dickinson. Hello guys.
Hello, how are we?
Hi.
I'm good. I just want to let everyone that's expecting us to talk about Manchester United to know that if you want us to hear us dissecting their performance, you can listen to last Monday's podcast where it pretty much was copy and paste. We're not going to talk about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and that handball and that penalty, but there will be much more to do with that later on in the podcast. We're starting instead with Manchester City and their 5-2 defeat at home by Leicester. Henry Winter writing in the Times, Leicester City's counter-attack masterclass had exposed City's weaknesses. I didn't really see it that way. I think City were half-hearted in their performance. I don't think we saw the best of them. I think their press was poor. Mendy and Tielemans in the midfield easily bypassed that threat. Barnes and Madison at times, Madison when he came off the bench and Barnes before that, you know, we're just walking onto the back four. And even though the defenders will be criticised at Manchester City, as they always are, I'm not really sure it was a back four issue and more of a team defensive display. And certainly the midfield area was poor. There will be credit to Leicester given later on, by the way. So Leicester fans, please do stay tuned. Guys, what did you make of it? It's worrying for Manchester City. 10 defeats in their last 36 Premier League games.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I don't think it's fair to say it was just a kind of a counter-pressing performance from Leicester. I think you're right, City's press is not what it once was, and I think if teams are brave enough now to try and play through it, which Leicester certainly were, then they can benefit from that. I think there's a sort of systemic question mark about City at the moment, but there is also, you know, issues about the defence. I think, you know, if I'm just looking back at some of Manchester City's defensive recruitment, and it's really pretty shambolic for the last few years. You know, John Stones, Mendy's doesn't look like the player he was after his injuries. You know, Zinchenko, I'm sure they would let go. Otamendi is on his way. Cancelo, 50 million fullback, who's really not lived up to that. Angelino, they've sent out on loan. I don't think Nathan Ake is the kind of saviour after all of that, you know, pretty poor recruitment defensively.
Danilo.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, Laporte is the one shining light really in all that. And I think, so there are issues, personnel issues defensively, but also kind of systemic issues as well, I think.
I think you're right as well, yeah. I mean, I think it was the lack of intensity, I think you mentioned, Hugh, that really struck out. That it was that, you know, we're so used to seeing City harass, you know, not just be beautiful footballers like De Bruyne, but they're capable of, you know, like Barcelona were at their best, where they pester you into mistakes. And I just don't see, it was the opposite, wasn't it? It was Leicester pestering City into endless mistakes. And that was what was so startling. It was, and you know, every time you saw a City defender turned, which was, you know, extremely frequently, they were, you know, making terrible mistakes on the back of it. And I mean, when you can see three penalties at home, then things are going pretty wrong. So I think it was so many. And the greatest irony, of course, I think, is that clearly Pep was looking for a solution in playing the two screening players, and that backfired completely. And when you see Fernandinho taken off, replaced by a teenage striker in a sort of bizarre throw of the dice, then it was just sort of, you know, it went from bad to worse.
I think City are weirdly one-dimensional. Even when they were storming the Premier League and no one could keep up with them, when they did falter, they faltered really badly. You know, when they were good, they were very, very good. And when they were bad, they were horrid sort of thing. It's as if one thing goes wrong for City, the whole beautiful system collapses. And I felt that Leicester, whether they knew it or not, identified that as a weakness. So all you, basically, from now on, all anyone wants to do when they're facing City is maybe play five at the back. It doesn't necessarily have to be that. But if it suits you as a team to find a way to frustrate City, keep them at bay for the opening 20 minutes, you might be able to concede a goal. The point is, if you frustrate them, remain confident, and then start playing your own game, they will falter. And you had the added problem with City that as soon as it's out the bag, that they're mortal and they have injury problems and suspension problems and COVID problems and people missing, they lose their aura. And when he has to overthink it, just as he did in the Champions League, Pep Guardiola does strange things. So he took off Fernandinho, who you need on the pitch for his experience and his calmness, and he brought on somebody who was 17 years old in Liam Delap. Why would you do that? Because you're overthinking it. That is not going to solve a problem where a team with energy and quite evident self-belief that they could get a result were hammering away at you. Don't put it on the shoulders of someone who's never been in that position before. So I just feel with City, it's like a pack of cards. You just tip the edge and off they go.
It's also quite a kind of familiar pattern now as well. I think Brendan Rodgers was quite explicit afterwards about their game plan. He said if we'll sit in a kind of mid to low block, and also he even raised the question of that was kind of negating the power of the goalkeeper. Sort of utilising the space in behind. Sometimes City, you know, they just launch a ball in behind you if you press them too high. So he said we didn't want to have that threat, and then we just had to have the bravery because we were saying Leicester pestered them. They weren't pestering City high up the pitch. It was always really in and around the middle of the pitch, and they would nick the ball, and then they had the bravery to play through them. And they also had the kind of the pace of Barnes and Vardy and to kind of threaten them in behind. So. It was you've got to give Leicester credit. I mean, yes, they did have three penalty kicks, that helped. But you've got to give Leicester credit for exposing the kind of, you know, you can't say, like the Twitter meltdown that Pep's a bald fraud. He's certainly not that. But there is a kind of a subtle shift towards the kind of the values of pressing as being almost more important. You know, that philosophy, the kind of German style of football, is kind of edging away from the Spanish side of football. You know, Klopp is the kind of figurehead for that one style of play, and Pep is the figurehead for the other. And, you know, there's no doubt that the German is in ascendancy.
Can I just stick up for bold people at this point? I don't know what I mean, you know, calling him a fraud's not outrageous enough. Calling him a bold fraud, I think, is... There's some kind of discrimination going on here. But also should add that it wasn't so many... I mean, I was going to say weeks, days ago that plenty of people, maybe even myself, were thinking that, you know, City were potentially going to win the league. And you know, you do have to take into account, you know, you've got both strikers missing, you've got at least four or five players to come back in, you've got Laporte, as we've mentioned, obviously, to come back in, and you know, he's been absolutely their outstanding defender for a couple of years, and they're just about to spend another 60-70 million on another, you know, highly regarded centre half. So, you know, it's City will recover, that's for sure.
To be complete on this, Matt, I think the criticism is that he's a bald fraud who wears tie-dyed sweatshirts as a Premier League manager.
I'm with you on that one. There's not a tie-dyed T-shirt in my house. I can vouch.
I was desperate for Matt there to just be like, "What, one of these?" and show that he was wearing a tie-dye T-shirt. That would have been an awkward moment. But you're right, Ruben Dias from Benfica coming in. I think it's £65 million rising to a possible £71-odd million. I mean, it's huge money once again spent by Manchester City. They've already spent £41 million on Nathan Ake. But there are people saying... lots of people saying, well, look, are we about to see why Pep Guardiola doesn't last longer than three seasons at any team? You know, is it all unraveling, spending that much time with a manager who is so intense? Do the players need a bit of a break from his kind of personality? I wonder what you think is going wrong, or if anything is going wrong at Manchester City. I previously, when discussing Manchester United, had said a lack of a pre-season, a lack of preparation time on the training ground shouldn't have had such a huge effect. But if you look at Bayern Munich this weekend losing their first game in the Bundesliga, 4-1 no less, Paris Saint-Germain lost their first two games back in Liga, Inter Milan conceded three on their first game back in Serie A. Do you think there is an element of a lack of prep time that's affected Manchester City?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the teams who are affected most by this is the are the teams who made it to the latter stages of European football. So undoubtedly, this season has got all the ingredients for being, you know, a season of absolute chaos. You know, the sheer volume of games that are going to be squeezed in, you know, still uncertainty about, there's games below the Premier League have been cancelled because of coronavirus. Who knows, that could happen. And as you say, the teams who have had the worst preparation are the teams who would expect to be challenging for the title and for European places. So, yeah, they've been affected as badly as Manchester United, certainly. Still, I don't want to break out the tiny violins because, you know, when you hear Pep saying about the number of injuries they have and, you know, I'm going to have to use youth team players, well, good. You know, that's a good thing. I think he should have used them more in the past. They've got the best academy in the country. And you saw, you know, Chelsea used some of their players last season and it had a positive effect and the supporters really warmed to that. So, you know, there's nothing wrong. They've got plenty of players to call upon.
There is a madness in, as you say, in the, I mean, pure financials, but when you consider the amount of money they have spent on defenders, and as you consider that, yeah, as I think most of us sort of thought with Aki, that, hang on a minute, this is looking like 40 million quid for a guy who's going to spend a hell of a lot of time as first reserve centre-half. And then, you know, where does that leave John Stones sinking? Well, sinking like one. You know, it's not... they have spent hugely on a defence that is still needing sort of propping up. And that's... that doesn't say a lot for that part of their scouting.
There are people that make the point as well. I saw a few Manchester City fans talking about Pep signings in general. I know you mentioned the defensive signings, but maybe saying the team's being carried by people who Pep didn't sign in the past, Aguero, Kompany, Silva, De Bruyne, Fernandinho. Does Pep Guardiola have questions to answer about his recruitment further up the pitch as well?
we're all screwing up our noses.
Everyone's grimacing because they've spent loads of money on loads of good players.
Yeah, I mean, look, they have still got lots of very good players, and they score a lot of goals. They score a kind of unprecedented volume of goals. So I really don't.
There's a quality of player argument, and I know that that's the point that you're making, but in terms of the characters in the squad, in terms of that strength of leadership, you know, Alisson mentioned Fernandinho being taken off already. Have they brought in anyone else who, okay, they're all elegant footballers, but anyone else that really has that winning element to them other than the players that Pep didn't buy?
So, I mean, if you cast your eye around, there are not many of those around. I think Manchester United need someone like that too. I think Chelsea do. Although they signed Thiago, you know, you look at all the players they brought in, they look like really kind of elegant, polite, nimble-footed little attackers. There's not really anyone there that's a leader. So I think that's probably quite a commonplace, you know, problem at the moment. I'd say, you know, I think you could bring Rodrigo into this, because, like, he was supposed to be the replacement for Fernandinho, and at the moment, if he's the kind of the man in the middle, I don't think he looks dynamic enough to perform that role. So that's another area, you know, he's cost a lot of money. Really, it seems to be at the back that they're struggling to find players who are good enough, really.
But Hugh, you're listing players who a lot of them aren't there anymore, and then you're that means you're heaping even more pressure on the established pre-Pep players. So against Leicester, Kevin De Bruyne was really quiet. Now, that only he can know truly if that's because he was shocked by how good Leicester were, or, you know, he's entitled to an off day. I think we do bleat on about how beautiful a player Kevin De Bruyne is, but we forget that if the pressure on him to perform because of what that does for the rest of the team, often I feel they float City because he's spraying around the beautiful passes and reminding them of how elite a team they are, and they are inevitably going to win this game because they've got Kevin De Bruyne. And that must be an enormous amount of pressure. And the proof of it is, if he has a deeply average performance, they don't tick along very well.
Matt, do you have a view on it?
I think if I had one actually doubt about City, well, I guess it was both ends. I mean, obviously, as I say, we're expecting them to sign Diaz to play with Laporte and shore up the centre-back, but at striker, you know, if Aguero at his age and being more injury-prone, you know, Jesus has a bit like Gregor was saying about Rodri in the middle, is that, you know, he's been bought as the sort of, you know, the heir to Aguero and has shown sort of, you know, flashes of it, bits of it, but not, you know, no one ever quite believing that he is, you know, the answer for a team of that good, and certainly not Aguero's class. And I guess it's the not dissimilar situation where, you know, you're talking about a clear talent, but not one that's actually sort of ready to carry that sort of huge expectation. So, you know, I mean, say we're giving City a fair old kicking here, aren't we, for a team that,
yeah,
say that,
yeah,
you know, say I'm expecting to, well, certainly, yeah, still expecting to give Liverpool a heck of a run for their money. But I think, you know, there was a few extraordinary factors about that performance. I think there are a few extraordinary factors about the start of this season, and I think we're going to see a few upsets like this. I think we're in an unprecedented time for managers trying to get teams together and get them bedded in. But, you know, which doesn't mean to say we shouldn't be asking those extra questions, as you say, about Guardiola, and does he tire people out, and does he, you know, what is like the intensity, and how does he work in these unprecedented times?
I still like your analogy of City having issues at both ends, Matt, to be honest. You decide which end you think their performance reminded you most of, though. Let's talk about Leicester City. Pretty good performance from them, shall we say. First time they've won three top flight games for the first time in their history. Brendan Rodgers at length to describe a different approach being the thing that, you know, that's not necessarily the football he wants to play despite scoring five. Gregor mentioned the low block, the deeper defence element of things. But I thought they were excellent, and I think the credit for the scoreline must go to them. Slightly disappointed that Pep Guardiola said that Leicester had basically come to defend, not to play, especially as they'd scored five goals. What did you make of Rodgers' tactics, though?
Well, talking of frauds, I guess we should say, you know, that, you know, maybe Alison, we'll get Alison to chip in on this one, but she, not being Brendan's greatest fan, but I think, you know, I think he's shown many times that he's a serious coach. You know, he's a guy who knows football. You know, he comes, it almost feels obligatory to mention, you know, he comes with certain aspects of him that seem to polarise people, but I think people, you know, it's long overdue that people just give him a basic level of respect, that he is, you know, a guy who knows how to coach a football team and knows, you know, how to prey on weaknesses like City showed. So, yeah, you know, he's taken a Leicester team that obviously had, you know, the freakiest season ever, but he's making them a different team, a better all-round team, and they're doing it with some pretty shrewd signings. So that Castagna's just the latest in a way to take a very good team and keep improving them. They are, you know, punching their weight and more.
It felt personal, Alison.
I disapproved of Brendan Rodgers being manager of Liverpool, and let's leave it at that. But I was live at Leicester's first two games of this season, and they, Burnley and West Brom, and they were, and so I only saw the Man City one on telly, but they are, and I did raise the point that they've done I think properly for the first time since they won the title, is they've tapped into how they won the title, which is they play unashamedly when they can play, and they make the most of when they're on the break. I don't think there's a team that plays on the break as thrillingly. They have had this amazing ability in the transfer market to sell players for big money and replace them with players we don't know very much about who slot in seamlessly. Matt quite rightly mentioned Castagna. I mean, he scored on his debut and looked like he'd been playing for Leicester for 6 years. It was quite incredible, and he's getting better with each game. I'd rather have him in my team than Ben Chilwell at the moment. And it's bizarre, isn't it? So if you've got that going for you, an ability to regurgitate, replenish, not feel diminished by selling the more famous players, if you like. But you've kept Jamie Vardy there, who's the sort of lifeblood and effervescence of the team. And when you watch them live, they look awfully like they did when they won the title, which is you just can't knock them. You can't make them feel like they're outclassed. There's this amazing level of palpable optimism. And that's how Jamie Vardy sort of flicked goal against City. It was outrageous, but you don't score goals like that against City unless you simply don't care who you're playing and you actually believe you've clicked and you've got something magical going. So I think they're going to be hard to stop. They're doing better than they started that season that they won the title. So come on, let's imagine that they're going to. Let's think what it would be that would stop them, because it doesn't seem to be much at the moment.
I think it's more than not caring who you play against. I think it's relishing. Vardy relishes playing against them. He scored 8 goals against them since Guardiola's been there now. And I was also reading that Messi's the only other player that scored a hat trick against the Pep Guardiola team. So he's get obviously 2 of them were penalties. That was an exquisite finish, though. And the 1-2 before it, again with Castagna, was a strange one. He played it back to Tielemans, I think, and then made the run forward. And Tielemans played a brilliant sort of incisive pass down the line, and the cutback was perfect. So yeah, I think everything that's been said is true. I think that Rodgers deserves credit. It was a strange way that Leicester kind of ended last season, and that after January they looked like they couldn't really score a goal, or they weren't creating the chances in any way, anywhere close to the same volume. And it was hard to really put your finger on why that was. I think Tielemans was someone who came in and made a really big impact at first, and then he fell away a little bit, and perhaps it's understandable. But I agree, and the tactical approach to the game, it kind of ties in with what Matt was saying about Rodgers, and that he was very keen to explain it afterwards too. You know, he's happy to say, this was my plan and it was executed very well. But it was, you've got to give him great credit, and Leicester were excellent.
But you keep saying, Gregor, you know, there were a lot of penalties in that game. That isn't a negative, that is a positive. They have pace and audacity in the box, and they ruffle defenders. That is an asset.
Yeah, it is. But I think, you know, we've got enough to argue about with the handball rule today, but I think the number of times that strikers are running across a defender or even just throwing a leg into the kind of groin of a defender and tangling and going over, it was particularly embarrassing this weekend. There was a number at Brighton and, it, you know, I can't remember his name, Connolly is up front?
Aaron Connolly, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he went down 2 or 3 times in that game. This weekend was particularly kind of obvious how much that is now a tactic for strikers, because any contact, you'll go over. I think one of the penalties was probably fair for Leicester, but I think probably, you know, the second one was a little bit harsh, personally.
I know we digress slightly, but I do agree with you on that, Gregor. There's this sort of element of anyone that's played netball, that if you just, you're running full tilt and you suddenly stop and the person who's chasing you collides, like touches you in the back, and suddenly it's a foul, which is fine in that sport, but in football I think is a bit weird. But it seems to be a new technique of getting across your man, digging your studs into the ground, stopping abruptly, and then, you know, initiating the contact with the person behind you, but clearly looking like you've been barreled over. It's coming in more and more. But listen, we'll have a lot of penalties this season. Matt, you've got a view as well.
No, I'm just saying, I've seen even the saintly Harry Kane does that, doesn't he, in these days? It's just that, you know, whereas I think he did it against Arsenal last season, was it? And he's done it a couple of other games, as you say, where you just do that check and just wait for the bang. And that is one of the let's not start the VAR chat. Let's not go too early. Let's not go too early on that. But you're right. But there is a bit of skip. But I disagree on the Leicester one. I think that was that was clearly tactical of just work. Vardy. I mean, we know Vardy's probably the best in the league at it. It's just his he's just a guy who's very smart about timing runs, about getting on the shoulder, and about particularly targeting the blind side of a run of Garcia. He was just, you could just see, just like he basically schooled the kid in what it's like to be blindsided with all these runs.
It was put to me yesterday though that Premier League players are not being penalised for when they do dive. So when VAR sees that a player has clearly gone down very easily, they don't say you need to book that player for diving. And I think because there's been no real scrutiny or punishment for those attempting to dive, it's encouraging players to do it more and more, because Connolly easily could have had a red card against Manchester United, but he didn't get booked for any of those. So I don't believe so anyway. So if there's no deterrent, it will continue.
Absolutely.
But it's not for yellow card offences, is it? That's and if you start doing some yellow card offences, then that's we could do that. I mean, I'm not saying I'm on the argument that diving should be punished, but if you go down the VAR road for that, then do you say that's the only yellow card offence that you punish, and then you're opening up a whole new can of worms? As if we need another can of worms.
We've opened up the VAR can of worms already, haven't we?
Good. I have to say, in lockdown, cans of worms are going strong, aren't they?
I did want to mention one more thing on Leicester City. Jamie Vardy's performance, because of course he gets the headlines for scoring a hat-trick. Gregor, you'll mention there were a couple of penalties in there. And I was sort of wrecking my brain to say what superlatives can we put in about Jamie Vardy's performance, and all I could think was it was completely expected. It's exactly what you think he would be doing approaching that game. I mean, what was on the film? What were Manchester City watching in terms of their prep? Because it's what he does. I couldn't fathom that they could make him look so brilliant doing it when that's one of Leicester's major threats.
Vardy's got 10 and 11 appearances against Arsenal and 7 and 11 against Liverpool. I think, he's in the big games. Vardy, I don't know if it's something about the fact that, these are playing against teams who are going to come out and probably try and dominate the ball, more than Leicester, and that gives the space for Vardy in behind. But it's not just that. He's kind of tailored his game as he's got older. And, I think Rodgers deserves some credit for that too, and that he's conserving a bit more energy. But also, even when teams kind of sit back and don't allow him that space in behind to be, which is his primary threat, he's still kind of managing to snaffle the yards of space in the box and produce finishes like he did there. Yeah, I mean, Vardy keeps going from strength to strength, and it's remarkable. Great story.
I did see one comment made. I can't remember what I was watching in terms of the analysis, but one of the pundits did say the old Jamie Vardy would make 50 runs and get the ball, seven or eight times. Now he makes 10 runs and gets the ball seven or eight times. That conservation of energy at his age, we saw what he did last season. You're right, you do have to credit Brendan Rodgers with that. But in front of goal, I mean, you just don't doubt his mentality either. This is a player who hasn't been in the Premier League for their entire career. He steps up to take a penalty. You never really think there's a chance of him missing it, to be honest. And even in front of goal, in and around the penalty box, he's as sharp as anyone. I'm not even going to mention England, to be perfectly honest. I was thinking about it for a second. But he does seem to get better. He's ageless.
Well, he does. I'll mention England if you weren't there, because I criticised him for it in the sense of, his life, his decision, but I was just disappointed by it. And I just felt it was premature. And then Mrs. Vardy got very upset with me. But I think, I guess if you flip it and see it from her point of view, and as you say, to back your point up, there was a certainty about him. He just thought, well, I'm not, I think I should play. I'm not playing, therefore I'm walking away. And there was a sort of almost conviction about that, that maybe is, say, the same conviction in himself that we see from the penalty spot. And that, and I was literally listening to the radio when the game was live and heard about the flick goal, and they were just saying, make sure you get to watch Match of the Day just for that goal, and it was worth it. It's just one of those, yeah, I mean, we all know the certain types of goals he can score, and those, you know, fleeting through, dashing through behind on the shoulder, etc. But that was just, yeah, it was one of the, I love a goal that has a flick or a bit of deftness about it. Yeah, they're my favourite goals more than the cannonballs. And yeah, that's the new bar for the season for me to be beaten.
We get very sniffy about players who turn their back, in inverted commas, on their country. But sometimes, especially when you're getting on a bit, surely you have to work out whether you sort of eke out your career, giving a little bit to your club, a little bit now and again to your country, or you go wholeheartedly into thinking, well, if I only concentrate on one thing and I know what I'm doing, I know who I'm playing with, I know my strengths and weaknesses, I know how tired I get, I can last a little bit longer. So you've got to say it was the absolute spot on 100% right decision from him, because for him, he knows how much energy it takes just to be part of the England setup. You might not get on the pitch, but knowing that you're a sub and thinking, having to watch the game and where you might or might not fit in, I imagine, I've not done it myself, I imagine it's incredibly draining. And to have that gone from your life will give you a new lease of life, I would have thought, surely.
If we're talking about England, could I quickly just say that Harvey Barnes has to be close soon too, because he's a remarkable player. I think, you know, someone power running with the ball, power and pace and kind of, but still the ball's always under his kind of mastery. I think he's an exquisite player. I think he's improved as well under Rodgers. You know, Rodgers gave him the kind of trust. He had a really positive spell at West Brom, and he was brought back by Puel, and it was kind of, you know, he was in and out briefly, but Rodgers has really said, no, you're a key player for me. And yeah, I think he's going to be a big player for England, actually.
Absolutely. He looks different as well this season. He's trimmer. He just looks like he's worked hard on his physique, and he's far more influential, and he's clearly more confident. Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that.
I think Harvey Barnes was one of those players Brendan Rodgers just had to say, I know you can skin anyone just by knocking it past them and going, but at times, just get it under control, bring others in. He's learning. He's certainly improved. A lot of competition, though, on that side of the pitch for him with England. And I think he's added assists this year. I just think in front of goal, that's the one thing that I think he just needs to improve. But a young player who's growing and growing, and I'm sure he'll have a great future with England. Just on Jamie Vardy, little stat for you. He has now scored 2 hat-tricks against Pep Guardiola sides. The only other player who has scored 1 hat-trick against a Pep Guardiola side is Lionel Messi, meaning officially Jamie Vardy is better than Messi. You heard it here first. You're listening to The Game. If you're enjoying us for the first time, by the way, just hit the subscribe button now. You will not miss any of our episodes throughout the season.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, let's talk about football's latest outrage, the latest annoyance with football's rulemakers, of course, 2020's version of The Game's Gone, which, it's just hit me, should really be a feature on this regularly. The not actually new handball rule that is actually now just being enforced. Journalists, players, ex-players, broadcasters, former refs, coaches and managers all incensed by it. There were 2 big issues this weekend. Eric Dier's handball versus Newcastle for Spurs. Joel Ward for Crystal Palace against Everton as well. Who thinks this is the death of the game as we know it? I'm not understating it, by the way.
Oh my goodness. It's remarkable, isn't it? I mean, you know, we've got empty stands, we've got actual football clubs that are close to real death, and yet the handball rule is what's going to kill the game here. I don't like it, but I mean, I also really find myself laughing quite heartily at the number of current pros, and certainly lots of ex-pros who are, you know, using the capital button on Twitter and saying this is killing the game and an outrage and the game's gone. It's not gone. We don't like the rule. I think, you know, Roy Hodgson's kind of little video clip went viral, and there's a reason for that, because it was sensible. You just have to sort of step back for a moment and think, why did the handball rule exist? It was to stop people, kind of defenders stopping the ball from going in a goal with their hand, or strikers controlling it on purpose and scoring a goal, or Maradona punching it into the net, no matter how hilarious that was as well. You know, so this has just gone, it's just gone down to a kind of an alleyway, which means that any time the ball strikes a defender's hand in particular, you know, VAR can pick up on it. And, you know, you see the numbers, there was a nugget in Bill, in Bill Edgar's column today, that at the current rate there would be 292 penalties this season, and the Premier League record is 112. So, like, I'm sure that's unlikely, but it shows you how marked the kind of change is. And, you know, the stats about how many penalties there were in La Liga and Serie A last season, I think it was like 48 and 57, and this in the Premier League was 20.
19, yeah.
19, sorry, yeah. You know, it's just, the change is remarkable. And, you know, it's all true. It's not a rule that any of us like, and it feels unnatural. It doesn't feel like it should exist in football, but it's not killing the game. It's certainly giving us a talking point too.
Now, you can see, I mean, there was, you know, I'm not going to defend the rule, that's for sure. You can offer, I guess, an explanation for the thinking, which was that, you know, let's try and find a way of, you know, especially given the use of VAR, let's try and find a rule that makes this consistent, so that, because people talk endlessly about subjective decisions, etc., so you can sort of imagine the discussion, you know, taking place in, you know, IFAB HQ, some bunker in the middle of Switzerland, presumably. I wonder about that. But you'd like to think that that's the point where, you know, someone would have said, but let's just sort of roll this out and think of the effects and think of the. And they've had, you know, I guess what annoys me as someone who thinks that, you know, say, if we can't make VAR work, then we're being pretty thick. So what annoys me is that at the 2018 World Cup, this was already shown up to be the glitch. You know, there was one game, was it Iran-Portugal, I think. Then there was the final itself, obviously. You know, you can't get more high profile than the World Cup final when you've got an argument about a handball that's one of those ball, you know, ball flashes in from a set piece, arm sort of jutting out. And so that's what really winds me up, is that, you know, we've had 2 years since that World Cup to know that these handballs were, you know, the game didn't like them, and that's it. So that's my frustration.
But just on that, Matt, we've had 2 years also as pundits, as players, as we've seen it 2 years ago. The idea that, like, this weekend is the weekend that everyone's gone, oh my god, this is terrible. It was terrible 2 years ago. So surely we had an idea of what
Absolutely.
It was going to be.
That's like Gregor says, you know, it's like, you know, that sort of, you go on to you know, you say you should never judge the world on Twitter. That way insanity lies. But it is hilarious when you go onto Twitter and you sort of see, you know, sort of, you try and work out what people are getting more angry about, you know, COVID, Donald Trump's tax returns, or handball, you know, and it's like,
it's close.
You know, and it's pretty close between the three. And, it, you know, that's, you know, that's life.
The other thing is that you know, the Premier League didn't adopt it. They didn't adopt this rule. You know, now it's kind of, IFAB have said this has to be global. So that's why there's outrage this season, really, because no one really looks outside outside of England, really, the majority of people anyway. And the thing is that when England last tried to say we're doing it our own way with VAR, it was a disaster last season. You know, you couldn't, the referees weren't going to go and look at the monitors, and they've kind of rolled back on that. So I think we need to be slightly careful. You know, I think we should probably expand our horizons a little bit and see how Serie A and these other leagues are feeling about it now, after a year. I'd say there's some relevant questions to be asked about that.
The key here, I think, is that IFAB changed the rules on handball, and where they had said it may be a handball offence if a defender, the ball strikes his arm, it is now. There's no may involved. It is. And I think the PGML have misinterpreted that to mean that all handballs are now penalties, which is not what is meant at all, because the point IFAB's trying to make is, if you deem it an offence, it is a penalty. You can't get subjective at that point, but there is still room for subjectivity in whether the defender has made his body in a natural position. And this, I was at Spurs on Sunday, and this is what was really annoying people, and Steve Bruce in particular, was because he was asked, how are you going to coach your defenders? What are you going to say? And he said, well, you can't tell a defender he can't jump with the player he's marking and not expect him to lift his arms up, because it's impossible to jump if you don't do that. So that's really simplistic, isn't it? And you know that if you're 8 years old. So why on earth are people on VAR, and then the referee, when he looks at his monitor, why have they suddenly, out of the blue, decided that to jump is an unnatural act when it isn't? Eric Dyer's arm was not in the air. It was not unnatural. The incidents we're discussing, none of them are unnatural. And therefore, under the new rules, you are allowed to say it is not a penalty. The only way it is a penalty is if you decide it's an unnatural position. And I think, weirdly, IFAB taking out the fact that if the ball ricochets off someone's knee, or if the ball hits your arm and it's very close to you, they are not fouls, they are not misdemeanors. You are allowed to get away with that. For some reason, we here, more than any other country, as far as I'm aware, are being hypercritical of a defender's positioning. So I think there's room for Mike Riley to put up his hand and say, actually, yet again, we've adjusted to VAR badly and to the new rule badly, and we need to accept what is meant by unnatural.
I'm not sure we're the ones being hypercritical on the rule, though. As Gregor pointed out, 57 penalties for handball in Serie A last year, 48 in La Liga. The first half of Juventus against Roma last night, there were two.
It's the rule.
I mean, there were fans in the crowd who didn't look overly happy, but clearly they've learned to accept it somewhat over the last 12 months.
But this season, I think we've started like a train, haven't we? It's like we're going to overtake the rest of Europe at this rate.
the natural silhouette, it says outside the natural silhouette. So, you know, so the problem is, that's subjective in itself. How can you, a natural silhouette changes depending upon what action you're doing on a pitch. It's like when you saw the Tottenham players now, who have been clearly trained to run up and close somebody down with their arms behind their back. I don't know why I'm doing this when you can't see my arms, but but you know, there's that is an unnatural silhouette. That's unnatural. You know, you have your arms out by your side for balance. Joel Ward's arms were by his side for balance, and the ball hit him in his arm, and they gave a penalty. That was a natural silhouette. So the idea of this, you know, that's still somehow subjective. It's not really. I think they're saying if your arms aren't by your side and it strikes your arm, even if it's accidental, that's a penalty kick. So the referees don't have a choice. Isn't the referee's fault?
I would say those that say it's going to ruin football, well, it patently has not ruined football in Serie A or La Liga. So I think that's slightly premature. But you're right, there are bigger issues facing football as well, Gregor, aren't there? Go on, Matt.
But no, when you say that, there's the sort of daftness of it's killing the game and it's the death of the game, as if football can't survive this. I mean, that's just crackers. And also, you know, it's always, any of these debates, I think, always have to be framed in the context, to me, of football has a, you know, absolute core deep culture of arguing about decisions in a way that other sports do not. You know, one of my kids plays a bit of school hockey, and they, you know, ball hits the foot, whether it's deliberate or not, you get a penalty. And, you know, that strikes me as almost, I mean, the game's slightly higher scoring, but strikes me as the punishment doesn't fit the crime at all. But, you know, you don't get, I don't think the hockey podcasts are full of endless screaming and shouting about, you know, the rights and wrongs to that rule. It's just, you know, people get on with it, shall we say. And I think football, you know, whether it's subjective or we're trying to get this consistency, wherever we draw the line on this, people are going to get angry. People are going to scream and shout. People are going to say the referee's an idiot. People are going to say, you know, that this doesn't work, because that is what we do in football. We scream.
Matt,
and
you
shout.
You clearly haven't listened to the latest hockey podcast from the Times, mate. It's vicious. It's vicious. And go on, Gregor.
But do you not think that this actually, and all of the last couple of years, is kind of making, well, I don't know, maybe I'm giving people too much credit, but is it not making people realise that referees aren't idiots, actually? And that it was a tough job, and that now it's probably even tougher because they're having to watch slow, like marginal, you know, minute kind of slow motion replays to make a decision, which kind of alters the view of what of an event that they've seen in real time. So, you know, I think part of this makes you think, I'd like, you know, I want the control, the power, and of the decisions to be in the hands of the referee more. That's what I have gleaned over the last couple of years from after the advent of VAR, basically.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, I really hope that is. I think that's what a great end point that would be, though. As you say, a guy with, you know, two blokes with flags on the side and another bloke watching a you know, monitor in his ear, and that clears up the worst of the mistakes. And then there's a bit of subjectivity because that is what the job's always going to require. And we all go, that's the, you know,
and we
great,
remember how it was here. And we go, well, yeah, you know, yeah, you got it wrong, but what was it like before?
No, but here's, you know, here's four or five guys, another one holding up a numbers board, and, you know,
happen.
Four or five guys doing the best they can, and, you know, they've cleared up the worst of the mistakes. They might have got a couple of things we might disagree with, but well done, everyone. You know, the game was fair and we trusted them to do the best job possible. And if that ever happens, I'll eat my laptop.
But Matt, I remember because we've been doing podcasts together for many centuries now, and I remember the days when you would sit in caravans outside of football grounds watching the very, very first attempts at VAR and being absolutely in love with it and saying it was going to save football, and people were Luddites if they didn't get it. Can you honestly say now that you like the fact that the referee's there? He sees a couple of a header and a defender jumping. He lets the game go on. The ball's played out. A corner is won at the other end. And then someone in a bunker says, oh, there might have been. Oh, there might have been an, oh, I don't know. There might have been a handball there. Oh, let's spend 3 minutes checking. First of all, it wasn't offside, and therefore we don't need to make that decision. Oh, I think he was onside. Oh, right, now we have to look at, well, you know, we did actually strike his arm. I mean, he wasn't looking at the ball, but I mean, I'm under pressure. Do you think, Matt, that is bears any relation to what you hoped VAR was going to be when you really backed it at the start?
Bits of that do, bits that don't. I mean, I come back to the basic of, if we can't make this, it's a bloody, you know, it's a TV and a bloke watching it, and if we can't, you know, it's not, people call it technology, it's a bloke and a screen, and if you can't make that to the use of football, then, as I say, we're a bit bloody thick. The fact is that, you know, most other sports have managed to do it. And they're, you know, they get some stuff they like, some stuff they don't like. NFL tweets the way they used it many, many times. They didn't get it right first year. I think someone's mentioned they even got rid of it for a couple of years. That, you know, it took a bit of while. It took some glitches. Cricket has tweaked it endlessly. All these sports have taken the time to make it better and better. And that's it. And if football can't make find a way to make it work, then, as I say, we're pretty bloody useless. And I don't see that, you know, I just come back to the basic of, you know, if you're going to have 50,000 people in a stadium, X million at home seeing some blunder mistake, and they're all going to be screaming, you know, within 3 seconds, having seen a replay on their phone, going, you know, what's that bloody idiot doing? Now, if you don't just help the guy in the middle get that right, then, as I say, we're yeah, we're not very smart, are we?
There was a horror show in the NFL last year, and they immediately changed the rule so that VAR could have a look at it going into this year, or their version of VAR could, which it previously couldn't. So it shows you that you can change. Just on this, who's to blame? So many people tweeting the Premier League and FIFA. We just want to clarify, IFAB, there are 8 seats on IFAB. 4 of them are taken up by the 4 home nations FAs that we have, and the other 4 seats are for the rest of the world's football community. So if it is anyone's fault, it is ours, okay? Stop blaming the rest of the world or Europe or whoever you think was responsible, or Gianni Infantino. Blame us, basically.
Well said.
Happy Greg. Yeah. Happy Gregor.
Absolutely.
Listen, I wanted to end on this handball point or discussion with a bit of fun. And I was trying to think of the pinnacle of this. What would cause the absolute most outrage or joy of this handball rule being invoked at some point, whatever big game it might be, or whichever team or player we dislike or like the most for that matter? Who wants to start?
I'll start. So Liverpool are going for the decima in a Champions League. And they've signed this local lad. He's called Rodney Cucumber. And he's amazing. He's an amazing defender. But he's got an enormous nose.
Oh,
and it's, you know, it's 1-1 and dying seconds, and there's a header, and it hits his nose. And the guy on VAR is absolutely convinced that that counts as an unnatural position. And it's the hand of Rod, and it goes down as the day that football died.
Thank you very much, Alison.
You can tell Alison's a novelist, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
I think Gregor mentioned his hilarity at Diego's little bit of, I'm in, the hand of God in 86. I mean, it seems obvious to me that the way we want this is, don't we want, you know, Saint Harry of Kane punching one in against Argentina for England to win the World Cup, basically, don't we? And then and Gareth being very un-Gareth and going, you know, stuff it. We've got it back. So no, that's England win the World Cup thanks to a dodgy handball. Poetry,
Gregor.
I think, you know, there's no more controversial handball probably other than that from an English perspective than Thierry Henry's for France against Republic of Ireland. So I went into some weird imagination of a future when France and Republic of Ireland were drawn in the World Cup 22 playoff, and coronavirus was still around, and the French team got locked down, so Big Thierry had to come out of retirement and play against the Irish, and he flicks up the ball, it hits Shane Duffy's arm, and he scores the winner, and probably has to give him another €5 million to say sorry afterwards.
My one goes out to Tom Clark, and it's the dream. This is a dream for all football fans. A team from the lower leagues, Lincoln City, learning the lessons of their 7-2 defeat against Liverpool in the EFL Cup. They go on the Minnows Cup run to end all Minnows Cups runs. The draw's kind to them on the way. They reach the quarterfinals, dismiss Everton 4-1. They're on to the country's favourite semi-finalist, Manchester United. They beat them. They're back at Wembley for the final, and a chance of redemption against Klopp's Liverpool. Michael Appleton's side have lived the magic of the cup. They've captured the imagination of the entire nation. It's been a dream from end to end. And in the match, Lincoln give Liverpool a taste of their own medicine. They're 3-2 up with moments to go. 95th minute, a Liverpool corner. It's headed out. Firmino smashes it at goal. It's blocked. It ricochets onto a Lincoln hand. VAR calls Mike Dean over to have a look at the screen. Football fans, head in hand, penalty. Salah converts. Souness is absolutely delighted. Carragher deletes all of his angry tweets about it. Liverpool go on to win the match in extra time. And that is what football is now all about. overly officious rules. Guys, thank you so much for being with me. That was Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Matt Dickinson. You have been listening to the Game Podcast from The Times. If you enjoyed this episode, just make sure you give us 5 stars, review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Amazon Music or your favourite podcast app. Hit subscribe and you'll get Thursday's episode as soon as it's released. We'll see you soon.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.